We made this.
Welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. I am your host, Kurt North, and we are here celebrating 25 years of Millennium. In this episode, we have a new voice to talk to about Millennium in general, and that is Christopher Pilbeam, who is the writer of on the 25 Years Later site and joins me today. Christopher, how are you doing? How are things?
Yeah, I'm good. Doing well. Enjoying the autumn weather, he says sarcastically. How are you?
I'm not too bad. I'm back in my podcasting room and I do need to get some air conditioning in this area because it's just getting stupid now. I'm in here more than often than not and it's always really hot, which is quite ironic, bearing in mind this is going out in October
or
maybe early November. So it might be a completely different thing when we get there. But yeah, we are talking about Millennium. And one of the things that we were thinking about when the 25 years became apparent that was happening was, how are we going to celebrate? So what are we going to do as the podcast? The podcast finished at the end of season three. And we did a couple of specials like the virtual seasons and things like that, which all were fantastic. But we thought we couldn't let the 25 years anniversary slip by. So one of the ideas was to seek out people who may have caught the show later. And I hope I'm not being too thing here, but you didn't quite see it in between 1996 and 1999, did you, Christopher?
that would have been impressive, I must say. No, I didn't. I was born well after the show ended, so I'm very new to the Millennium camp.
Excellent, and that's part of the reason why we brought you on. One of the things I thought about was, getting someone who's got a new perspective on the show and. We can talk about that as we go through. And I thought that what the best way to do that would be is to use the initiation questions as a jumping off point, which we have for any new guest and obviously a new voice like yourself who has come onto the show now. And we can ask those five questions, but we'll do a bit more in depth view on that as we go along. So I think without further ado, we should maybe just do that. First up, then. Would be, how did you discover Millennium? So normally I would say, when did you discover it? And people will often say, oh, I saw it with the X-Files, I saw it with this, I saw it with that. Can you give us an idea of, what drove you to the X-Files? I'm aware you're an X-Files fan as well. You're a big Alex Krycek fan, as I know. How did that come about? How have you brought yourself into the TV world? What do you really enjoy about TV? And where does Millennium fit in you're watching as you've been growing up?
Yeah, so I mean, I've kind of always been into science fiction because my dad is into science fiction, so I grew up watching Star Trek with him.
Right.
And TV, as soon as I was of the age to start watching TV by myself, it was immediately something that I was obsessed with because it's like, I'm like one of those people who likes to kind of get really immersed and know everything, and TV's great because there's like so much of it. If you're into long running series, it's like it's never ending. And so I mean, particularly how I got into Millennium was through my love of the X-Files, which I'd been a fan of for several years. And also I'm an avid listener of the X-Cast. And so as the X-Cast was covering season six of the X-Files, I was watching the episodes along so that I could engage with the podcast. It was early 2021. I was becoming quite fastidious in my commitment to the X-Files. It was like I wanted to know everything. I wanted to read everything about it. Right. And I don't know exactly what episode it would have been on of the X-Cast, but someone mentioned the Millennium crossover episode, and it occurred to me that if I was going to continue watching along with the X-Cast, I was coming up on the Millennium crossover episode. And so if right. there ever was a time for me to watch it, and, you know, I was like, it will make me more informed about the world of the X-Files if I can watch this crossover episode knowing who Frank Black is, you know. So originally I thought, it will inform my knowledge of the 1013 universe, which is what I want, because I'm really into the X-Files at the moment. And so that's why I decided to start watching it. I bought the DVDs of season 1 and 2. Season 3 is a bit harder to come by, so I went right. about that through unofficial channels. I watched all of them within time to watch the crossover episode before the podcast got to it. And like in the same vein, I watched all of Harsh Realm as well. Not that that took very long, but because like it was like I was so immersed in the 1013 world, like not only just in the shows but in the fandoms as well, because I had the podcast Facebook group and then everyone on Twitter, and so it was like I just want as much of it as possible. So I watched Millennium instead of revising for my A levels, which is the responsible choice, I feel.
Yeah, so you're all right if you go into forensic profiling and things like that, you'll be fine.
Oh yeah, I'll be set. No, but actually, it is interesting. Like I should mention, like I was listening to your coverage of Owls and Roosters while revising for my English A level, and I swear I ended up writing about something that you guys were talking about in my essay in the exam, because I studied Streetcar Named Desire, which is a play about a domestic setting that gets corrupted by like the external extra personal upheaval of the 20th century sort of intrudes upon this domestic setting. So thematically similar to Millennium in that sense. And I think it might have you guys were talking about Operation Paperclip, which of course like I knew about from the X-Files, but the way that you guys put it into context, I was like, oh, that's good, I'll use that. So that ended up in my English A level exam. So, you know, TV is educational.
Absolutely. So you mentioned about the not being able to get season 3, because this is a big thing for people who may not have seen the show, and just how to get access to it. I think it'd be even harder now to get into Millennium because of that. Now, I'm sitting here gleefully looking at 3 box sets of 1, 2, and 3 of seasons of Millennium. But then also I've got another box set which my late brother bought as well. So I've actually got 2 copies. So I'm sitting here gleeful going, no, I'm covered, and I've got some digital copies that I've backed up as well. But so how long did you take over that time then for 4 Millennium? Did you actually do a full binge watch of it? How long did it take you to go through the 3 seasons?
Season 1, I listened to the podcast of the pilot as soon as I'd watched the pilot, or maybe after Gehenna, maybe. And I remember like one of you was saying how it's not a show that you should binge watch because it's very intense. And I was like, yeah, that's interesting. And then I did like 1 or 2 episodes per day for season 1. I was like, I'm fine. It was quite maybe not the smartest idea. And then I took my time with season 2 because I had kind of high expectations for it, because you guys were not like subtle on the podcast about which season was your favorite. There was quite a lot of season 2 hype before I got there, so I took a bit more time with that. And then because I couldn't find the season 3 DVDs, and I was like, okay, well, I'll wait because they might show up on eBay. They never did. You can get them for like 30 quid, but no thanks. So I broke between seasons 2 and 3 to watch Harsh Realm, and then did a bit of digging on the internet, and like season 3 is like on the like some of the illegal streaming sites on the internet, so I was like, okay. Right. And then I think I pretty much I binged season three as well. So I binged one and three, but I savoured two.
Was it right for us to up season two as someone who has seen it for the first time and, you know, with that expectation? Was there any disappointment in that? One of the questions which you might as well ask you now was, what do you consider to be your best season? But having that, we've been, especially myself, Darren and Tony, are the three that were definitely saying season two is the best. Did that colour your expectations going in? Did it disappoint? Did it actually go above, or was it about right? How did you feel about season two?
Well, I think that I had high expectations, and then I watched the beginning and the end and Beware of the Dog, and I'm not keen of Beware of the Dog. Right. So I was a bit like, oh, is this what it is? But then, like a couple episodes later, is Monster, and that is, I think that's, I don't know if it made my top 10 after I finished season three, but it was definitely in my top 10 up until that point. And so I was like, oh yeah, now we're talking. And ultimately, yeah, season two is my favorite season. I think it's just like excellent episode after excellent episode. And like, you can't, a season that includes The Fourth Horseman and The Time Is Now, like, how could it not be my favorite? And yeah, so I think, yeah, and also because I like Peter Watts in season two more than perhaps I like him in the other two seasons. I mean, Catherine's not around so much, but she's still around. And I think that Lara Means is a really excellent character. And so you have like the core four characters in season two are really just amazing, and so I got more and more impressed as the season went on. And I mean, you guys were bang on about how good it is.
Seeing that you've been listening to The X-Files and watching The X-Files, and you know, it's a very 90s show. And what other TV shows? So obviously, bearing in mind that we've got The X-Files and Millennium's very different. What were your expectations going into seeing the pilot, for example? Because the pilot is a lot darker than what The X-Files was. And when you watched the first season of Millennium, how did that kind of, with a modern take on, you know, TV shows that we've got now, how would you kind of reflect on that in the 90s compared to what TV is now and what your expectations were with The X-Files being kind of the next, you know, the show that kind of spawned Millennium? How did that all collate in your head with a new viewpoint, you know, someone from who was born in, you know, in the 2000s?
Yeah, I mean, because I might be more used to seeing like the extreme darkness on television than people at the time would have been, because like I prior to this I'd watched Supernatural, for example, which can be quite grim, and even things like Stranger Things, which is still kind of I don't want to say upbeat, but kind of like X-Files upbeatness, you know, like it's colourful. Yeah. And the cast is really young. It's still got, like, it's still really bleak at times. And so, like, I'm used to that, but I was still shocked by the Millennium pilot. Like, it was still like nothing I'd seen before. I knew it was going to be darker than the X-Files, but I was trying to explain this to someone the other day. I was just explaining to my friend who's, to be fair, has seen neither show. I was just explaining how Millennium differed from the X-Files. And it's kind of hard because it's not just that, oh, gruesome things happen, because gruesome things happen in the X-Files. There's just like a tone about it that I think probably comes from Frank, probably comes from Lance Henriksen. The kind of like, it's somber, I almost want to say like humble, like, right. The X-Files can be quite flashy and like heroic, and Mulder and Scully chasing after trains, yeah. Whereas Millennium is more kind of dark like the groundwater of Millennium is bleak and dark because it has the apocalypse hanging over it. The X-Files is like, yes, yeah, some funny looking aliens sometimes come down and cause trouble, but it's fun because they bleed green. Isn't that cute? Is kind of how it feels different.
I think you're right. I think the mixture, I would probably say, is what's different. I mean, you do have the gruesomeness. You do have, you know, Krychek spilling out black oil out of his face, and you do have, you know, moments where it's really dark and bleak, but it's mixed with the light. And obviously, I Want to Believe, for example, you have them saying, yes, that they're looking for the darkness, and, you know, it's the light that's peering through. Well, and I think that there is that with I Want to Believe, which is kind of more Millennium than it is X-Files in some ways. But I do think that it's almost like the dichotomy of the two. So, you know, apart from obviously the likes of Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense, compared to the way that X-Files can have Rain King, you know, you just can't imagine a Millennium episode having Rain King. And I think it's more compressed that way. It's darker that way, I would say.
But I mean, like, if you just like look at the taglines or like the philosophies of the shows, because X-Files is quite optimistic. It's like an optimistic kind of sci-fi. Because, like, I Want to Believe and The Truth Is Out There. I mean, obviously you have Trust No One, but the ones that come up, and the one that comes up in the credits is The Truth Is Out There. That's like a hopeful message. Whereas in Millennium, it's the first season is Who Cares? Okay, ouch. And then The Time Is Near, which is like super ominous. It's not like, oh, we're going to go and save the day. The world is ending and there's nothing you can do about it. It's just like you said, like, you couldn't imagine, like, Mulder and Scully belong in The Rain King. Like, as much as it's, as people have issues with it, like, it's still an X-Files episode.
Yeah.
Frank Black wouldn't. Just like, you can't imagine Lance Henriksen delivering half the lines that that David Duchovny does over the course of the show.
You said you listened to the pilot episode. Did you listen to along with the podcast, or did you stop the podcast and just listen and just watch the episodes? How did you do that?
So eventually I realized that I was going to get way too many spoilers if I listened to the podcast. So I finished season one, and then I went back and I listened to the podcast episodes for my favorite episodes. So, you know, I probably skipped the podcast episode for like Loin Like a Hunting Flame, but I listened to most of them, and then I watched all of season two, and then I listened to those, and watched all of season three and listened to those.
Talking about episodes, and so the second question would be, what is your favorite episode? So it's a good segue into that now, and I think I'm going to ask this question for all three seasons for you, but first up, what is your favorite episode out of the entire show's run?
The entire show. Okay, I'm gonna say The Time Is Now, The Fourth Horseman / The Time Is Now, but I think that it was like after the anticipation that I had for it, I was still completely unprepared for what it was, because I'd heard you guys talking about like Lara Means has a weird music video dream sequence. What's that all about? Man, I nothing I could have imagined. And I think that it's surprising. It's really creative is kind of a boring word to use, because it's like, it's TV show, of course it's creative, but it's aesthetically interesting as well. Like the scene with the phone call between Peter and Frank sticks in my mind really clearly, when they're in the two separate rooms and it's all like blue and clinical. Yeah. And I mean, like, my goodness, the absolute horror and heartbreak of the final moments when you realize what's happening to Catherine. I think that I haven't gone back to watch it since watching season three, because I'm worried about how the retcon will affect my experience of the episode. But I think the terror of an apocalypse is a hard thing to pull off in what, like, an hour, 2 hours of TV. They did really well.
Good. Well, that's good to hear, because obviously, you know, I mean, TV shows around now, if you were to relate Millennium to a TV show that you may have watched, you know, I know it's really difficult, but you know, you watch a lot of TV, so. What would you compare in modern day TV to Millennium?
My goodness, I would say, ooh, that's a good question. I would say that at some point, Like Supernatural is not a bad comparison. I think that obviously that's way more similar to the X-Files, but I still think that there are shared elements. You can see like Millennium's influence. I mentioned Stranger Things earlier. I think it has a kind of, at least in terms of like the finales, like a good like ramping up to like Cataclysm that they do. At the end, obviously, literally at Apocalypse, at the end of season two, but even the other two seasons have that a similar kind of intensity to it. I don't know. That's a hard question because it's honestly difficult to think of anything that compares to Millennium.
It is. And there'll only be touch points. I mean, for me personally, recently I've been watching The Leftovers, and I thought that that's quite not similar, but has a drew out quite a few different things in me. There's a bit of Twin Peaks in there, there's a bit of X-Files, there is the darkness of Millennium in that show as well. So there's that was a big one for me. And Hannibal, I don't know if you've seen Hannibal, but obviously Hannibal's you know, Brian Fuller has said that, you know, Millennium was a touchstone for him, so I think that those are the type of shows that that have echoes of Millennium in some ways.
That's true. Hannibal's a good answer. I don't know why I didn't think of that.
I wasn't trying to lead you down that way because I don't know what you've seen. But yeah, I thought Leftovers was really... I hadn't seen Leftovers. It was always a show that I wanted to see. And I've seen it in the last few months. And there is the darkness in that that sometimes it's like, yeah, I can see Frank living in this world to a degree. But okay, so we talked about favourite episode there. So that's season two. Season one... Just in general, what do you think of season one's style? And then if you had to choose one of your favourite episodes from the season, and what do you make of season one?
I don't know if this is like a controversial opinion, but season one might be my least favourite of the of the show. I mean, there was kind of, and to be fair, I did binge watch it, sort of, so it kind of blurred together, but I do remember like... making a list of all the ones I like, and then I looked back at this list after I watched season two and I was like, well, none of them are really compared to the season two episodes. Having said that, it gets off to a really good start. I think Pilot Gehenna and Dead Letters are three really good ones. I don't know, again, it's like I'm kind of like fond of it because it, which is a weird thing to say about something I watched like 5 months ago. Like, it's not like I'm not nostalgic of it, but I am fond of it. Like, because I remember what it was like when Frank and Georgian and Catherine lived together in the yellow house, and I miss that for them. But I'm not like super eager to like go back and watch like Weeds, you know, or like even Sacrament. Like yeah, I don't know. Some of it felt a little bit monotonous, but you know, it's the show's first season, you know.
Yeah, well, it's the first season, and I think you're not alone with that monotonous thing. I mean, season one I rate really highly, and it would be is my second favorite out of the three, and I think that. I really dig some of the dark tone of Millennium, but you're right, it does have that monotonous kind of thing as it gets into the middle of the season. It's unusual for TV shows to, you know, the kind of, it almost got stuck in a rut with, oh, I found what I need to do, but it was like replaying the same thing over and over. And X-Files did that towards the end of season one. You know, it was always like the dead are returning to avenge people. So there is an element of that for me. But, the fact that season one was the way that it is, that you've got the darkness, and I know that myself and Darren have talked about sort of the back end of the season, it kind of ramps up and you get the, you know, the stuff like Chip Johannesson's Force Majeure, you know, you get episodes like that, which are, you know, kind of quite different and obviously leading into season two. So that's interesting in itself. So if I was to really force you into saying what would be considered to be your favourite episode of season one, then... what would it be?
I think that it would be The Thin White Line. And I mean, I have my issues with it and there are issues with it, but I cannot help but enjoy it. When I recently wrote an article about Millennium for 25 Years Later, I had to rewatch The Thin White Line like several times, and I enjoyed it every time. And as much as like I know that it has issues, it's super compelling. And I remember this was like the pilot, and I enjoyed some episodes before that. When I got to The Thin White Line, I was like, oh yeah, this is why I'm watching this show. I like the kind of, I'm a big fan of the kind of you don't know what's real or not kind of thing. So when Jacob Tyler is having his visions and it's like, oh well, what really happened, I was like, yes, I love this. You know, like I'm really into Pusher and the X-Files and where people are seeing things that aren't there. But yeah, and I think that the conversations, like when you have the two characters like Hans and Frank sitting at that table just having a conversation, and it's just so good. And like how like a TV show that can pull off two people sitting in a room talking, and for me to be on the edge of my seat, I'm like, yeah, that was great. And like I know that it's not like one of the most popular episodes, but I really like it.
Okay, then season two. So we've already said that that's one of the favorite episodes of the show in season two. And you've also mentioned the fact there's like something like Beware of the Dog, which gets a bit esoteric. You've got, you know, various different episodes during the course of this season that you've got things like Sense and Anti-Sense, for example. And as you mentioned, Owls and Roosters, things like Hand of St. Sebastian. And the swerve that it takes. Now, obviously, you listen to the podcast, you're aware that people enjoyed it. What did you make to the kind of this swerve into this Christian kind of aspect of the show? And as you said, Peter Watts is probably his best work in this for Terry O'Quinn. But the reshaping of the show, what did you make of that when you first saw that? Because obviously you're aware that season two was different, but you know, how did you feel about that shift?
Yeah, so at first I was a bit like, I'm not sure if I'm going to enjoy this, simply because I know what it's like when the X-Files does religion, and I'm never really compelled by religious episodes, like with the exception of Signs and Wonders, which amuses me because that's a very Millennium kind of episode that maybe, yeah. So at first I was a bit like, you know, that cold open where the people are in the temple and they are retrieving the section of the cross. I was like, I don't know if I'm going to enjoy this so much, but, yeah. It turned out I really did. And I also really like In Arcadia Ego, for example. I think that ranks really highly for me. And obviously that's a very religious episode. It makes sense because, I really liked the division, having a split in the Millennium group. I thought that was brilliant. I was like, oh yeah. Because it's like in the X-Files when the Syndicate starts disagreeing about things. It's like, yeah, you have this group, and you know, at this point when the Millennium group is not exactly like the bad guys yet, but you know, they're on their way. And so it's like even the bad guys can't agree on the right way to be bad. It gives it nuance. Yeah. It's really interesting because it's so much better than just having like the Millennium group as this like monolith. It makes it more like, now I feel like there's more tension in the story, and it's really testing. It's about ideology, really, which is what's it's about religion, but like fundamentally, it's about ideology and faith and belief, which doesn't necessarily have to be about whatever Christianity or whatever. It's just how committed are people to the things that they believe in. And I think that it works so well in Millennium because Frank is committed to a set of beliefs about good and evil and what is good and what is not, and he's constantly tested on this, and so it makes sense that on the other side of the fence, you know, people who are set in their ways, such as the Millennium group, such as really devout religious people being pushed and tested, and is this what you really believe? And well, you thought that this was the right thing to do, but there's a whole other group of people who think that it's this. I just find that so interesting, and it really gave the show like texture that that perhaps that's what I found lacking from season one. Maybe that's why I wasn't so, maybe that's why where the monotony comes from. But yeah, I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it's exactly what we're kind of after, just to see, you know, a new perspective on stuff. So just in season two, they push the boundaries on what they're doing. Glenn Morgan, James Wong are renowned for like sort of episodes like Home in the X-Files, and they would use music, for example. So you've got In the Year 2025 in this season. You know, you've got the use of silence in The Curse of Frank Black and The Owls and Roosters. So were they, for you, seeing something like just the sheer amount of silence when the old man gets killed, or the kind of the really kind of slow movement of The Curse of Frank Black? How do you see them as episodes of TV? Because they are quite unique in the way that they're delivered, and the way that Glenn Morgan and James Wong work in that, and they've obviously done stuff like that in Space Above and Beyond as well, which they have an episode which is almost silent. Other TV shows are doing it. I think Evil recently, I haven't seen the episode yet, but I think they're doing a silent episode. So, you know, it's not unique, but at the time it was quite groundbreaking, you know, and Curse of Frank Black is a perfect example of that. But even like leaving the old man to be murdered pretty much in pure silence, stuff like that. How did you think that worked?
It's interesting that you mentioned music, because I kept noticing more and more the music, and I think that it worked great. Like having songs rather than just the score is something that Chris Carter mentioned, even when he was talking about the pilot, that this is a show that required a soundtrack, and I think it works really great. And the silence is like, yeah, I remember watching The Curse of Frank Black for the first time. I think I was holding my breath. Like it's use of silence is such an interesting thing, and it was used quite a lot in early modern stage plays. Is what it made me think of, like there's a moment in King Lear where a character who is blind is left on stage by himself, and it's just there's no like. There's nothing. It's up to the director how long can he hold his nerve to keep the silence going for. And I think it is really, it's really brave, because I guess different now from then. But a TV show doing that now, like, can you imagine with how short people's attention span is getting?
Yeah.
Like it was good. I feel like I like The Curse of Frank Black less than most people seem to. I think I was more like a Midnight of the Century. I think I preferred that, but I really appreciated The Curse of Frank Black. And you know, I wish more shows would do. I was talking about this the other day in terms of like something sparked a conversation in terms of like serialized television versus compared to shows that do like, I guess, Monster of the Week or whatever. Like,
yeah.
Closed end stories.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, and how that is becoming less common, and how people want an ongoing story. You have like an arc that like is broke, essentially one continuous arc that's broken up into 10 or however many episodes, and shows that like take a step back. Like people got furious at Strange Things for doing that one episode that's yeah. completely, and that frustrates me, because when a show can do like out of the way episodes, like episodes in black and white for the hell of it, because they can, because it makes sense for the show, or you know, episodes that like Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense, which seems to exist on like a whole other plane of existence, like alternate universe millennium. How would a show today handle doing Somehow Satan Got Behind Me? Because it's so unusual. It's unusual for Millennium, but it's unusual from like my experience of television. I mean, like I've recently been catching up with 90s TV. I watched Twin Peaks not long before I watched Millennium, and obviously that's very well, you know, what it's yeah. Twin Peaks, isn't it?
It is Twin Peaks. You don't need to say anymore.
That is true. Whereas now you have things, shows like. Science fiction shows like The Umbrella Academy, where it's just it's just one continuous story. And it's like the things that show could do if they had like one-off episodes, if they had the time to do event of the week episodes, the kind of creativity that comes out of it. And I've heard like Millennium sometimes described as like avant-garde storytelling, the way that they use editing, the way that they use sound, and I think that like it would be so great, because like we talk about seeing Millennium's footprint, but is it its footprint that it's left really just, oh, you can be dark, like you can show horrific things? Is that the legacy that necessarily the show warranted? Because I think that is only one small aspect of the show, and it's probably what people remember. Oh, it's Millennium, it's really dark. It's a really creative show. The way that they tell stories is it fascinates me, because I love storytelling. I love learning how to tell stories, and season two especially felt like a masterclass. Like, oh, you can you can do this one week and that next week, and you can have like this the Lara Means music video dream sequence thing. I can't get over it. it's like you don't have to there's no right way to tell a story. It feels like, especially in season two, there are just episodes that have their own flavor and their own kind of style. Like it's such a stylish show, and I wish that's what people remembered it for.
You mentioned Twin Peaks there. I mean, David Lynch is always pops up in my head with Chris Carter. There's comparisons between the two of them. They're very, you know, they are very similar aspects in the way they want to tell stuff, that they want to leave things open to the audience, that they, you know, there's a lot of things to compare the two. The thing with David Lynch is that he goes a lot more into that and dives into that, whereas Chris Carter still has that narrative mode of, you know, we still need to tell the story, for example. I know season two he wasn't involved in, but there is that aspect. And Glenn Morgan, James Wong, obviously, you know, there's people who automatically say, oh, it's Lynchian. And I understand that, because it's just the abstractness of the episodes. And I think that there's a lot in truth to that. But you're right with as I say, with the way that Millennium is told, that it was trying to push things at the time. You think in 1996 to 99, you know, it was trying to push things that bit further. And, you know, it got away with a lot. You know, the way that the Fox network was at that point, you know, it did get away with a lot, and it did push the boundaries. Twin Peaks, obviously, was 1989. So, you know, we're talking 10 years before. But still, it still kind of works in that regard. And you're right with saying that it's, you know, it's not just the darkness. There's a lot of the melancholy stuff actually works. Some of the, you know, the emotional stuff that kind of permeates through it. The, you know, even like sort of the love between Jordan and Frank comes through to a degree as well. So I do think there's a lot to the show in that way, because, you know, and it needs to be addressed. What I quite like, the, you know, like you mentioned Star Trek before, the Strange New Worlds apparently is going to be, you know, almost episodic again, but they still talk about the character development over the season, which Millennium does. You know, you see Frank at the beginning of season two and he's a completely different person by the end of season two. So I think there's an element of that, you know, there is still network television shows. Evil, as I said, is another one I've just been watching, and they are doing the same thing. They've got like a running story, but it's case of the week. So there is those things happening. With things like Stranger Things, it's really interesting that you mentioned that, because I don't know if I mentioned it on this podcast or maybe the X-Cast or somewhere else, but it's like there's this element of, oh, well, we'll go and look at this girl from a different city, and it's a filler episode. And I actually saw someone mention about the X-Files, and they said one of the episodes was a filler episode. I'm like, no, that's just a Monster of the Week episode. Yeah. Fillers don't exist. You know, I mean, yes, there was episodes that weren't as good written. And I alluded to like Lost. I don't know if you've seen Lost, but Lost has a couple of episodes where you could class them as filler, because Lost is in that mix of 2004 or whatever year it was, and it has an ongoing story, but it still is episodic with the breakup of the flashbacks. So there is this mode of like, oh, we'll just call it filler for filler's sake, and it's like, no, it's a character view. That was a character view on X, Y, and Z. And I think the only way that TV can work around that now is you have the story and you might have a one-off special, you know, like sort of in between seasons or something. I think that's the only way that TV is. And as you say, it's interesting the audience viewing, because this is a week-by-week episodic television show that was on in the 90s, and you would wait for the next episode the following week. And, you know, it feels to me that there is a bit of a sway back to that now with all the Marvel stuff. I don't know how you view TV nowadays, but the binge, we were talking about binge before. Now, do you think that, you know, the likes of, like, Stranger Things, which lands all at the same time, compared to, say, WandaVision or, you know, Loki or stuff like that, that is actually What If, like, which is currently on air at the moment at time recording. Do you think there's room that there has been a bit of a slight change in recent history with maybe going back to week on week episodes?
Well, yeah, I think I delighted in this kind of in the last couple of years, like it, when we started getting shows week by week again. I mean, even when Strange Things, you know, drops all at once, I watch it with my dad and we watch an episode per week, so we're just dodging spoilers for weeks on end.
Right.
And I appreciate watching week by week. I watched X-Files week by week up until season 8, and then I binged the rest. But like, I didn't have to because it was all out by the time I came to it. But there's something nice about it. I feel like you've got to appreciate like the difference between a TV show and a movie. Like, they're making a TV show on purpose, right? Like the thing about TV and film and how you pick what stories you tell and which. Well, and for a film, you can pretty much guarantee people are going to be in their seats for the whole 2 hours, whatever. So you can tell a tight story. You can tell a story that requires them to be super intensely focused and completely drawn in. Whereas for TV, if it's shown week by week, people get up and live their lives between the episodes, which makes it harder then to tell super intense, focused, beginning to end stories. You can imagine why people binge watch Stranger Things, because it's like it's a long film essentially. Yeah. Whereas I don't know, I'm not sure if I'm going to be an advocate for binge watching Millennium, because it is kind of a bummer to go one after the other. I feel like because I've been trained this way, the way that I've watched most TV shows, or at least the way I started watching TV on my own, as I've gotten older, I've kind of learned to appreciate the week by week thing. But like, the first, I remember I binge watched like all of The Big Bang Theory in like a couple of months, and that's like absurd. So I'm always been trained to do it. So I say things like I can binge watch and still appreciate each episode on their own, but I'm like, I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. I think it's a good thing that they're getting spaced out, because it also means that then the writers, the creators are going to start paying attention to what they put in each episode. This is it's the other thing with The Mandalorian, for example, and other stream. Oh, and Marvel shows. Is that the episode length is different now because they're streamed, which means they can do what they want. Like they don't have to fill out an episode in order for it to fit, or they don't have to condense an episode so that it fits a certain amount of time, which is great. And it's like, it goes with that. Like if the writers and the creators are all aware that they're not just doing a long movie, that they are telling a story episodically, that we want to see slow and incremental progression of character from beginning to end, and we also want to see complete rounded off stories and side characters that matter. This is the thing, like the side characters. I don't mean like Barry Baldwin. I mean like the characters who show up for an episode and then leave. If they have a complete arc in that episode, that's so much more interesting because they have to be given attention, they have to be given time, and so you meet all these people. Whereas, yeah, I don't know, I just feel like if it continues the way that it's going, that seems to be back towards a you get an episode and then you wait a week, that the way that TV is, the stories are going to be told in TV is going to be more like what I think TV is for, if that makes sense.
Well, I think for me, for my viewpoint, so when X-Files came out, for example, and Millennium, is that, and Star Trek and all the other TV shows I used to watch, but the week-on-week thing would be when I was, say, your age, would be a case of watch the episode, and then you'd probably watch it either at least one, but probably 1 to 3 times before the next one aired. So you'd have, like, a full understanding of the full episode because you don't have the... Oh, let's flick on, you know, let's go Leftovers this week. And, you know, you've got this episode. Oh, What If was on, I watched that. Then the next episode of this comes on, next episode of that. And it's an embarrassment of riches coming to you because you've got so much TV to watch. At that time, network television, you had 2 or 3 seasons of TV shows that you may be watching. And you would watch them, you know, 2 or 3 times. And I think that maybe gets lost a little bit with binge watching. I've been watched. As I say, Stranger Things is something that I've binge watched. And I always tend to struggle with remembering when things happen where. And that's the biggest thing for me. It's like you mentioned about Big Bang Theory. I did that as well. I binge watched Big Bang Theory. And I can, when I see them on TV now, I'll turn the channel over and go, oh yeah, but I'm not quite sure what happened there because I don't know when in the world that happened in this grand scheme of things. And I think that's interesting in itself. But moving on then. So season 3. So, you know, you took a while to get to season 3 and then you, as you say, you binged it. So what did you make to the change in style? And, you know, did you know much more from us about what happened in season 3 or... did the general consensus of it? How did season 3 come to you?
Well, I kind of knew 2 things, and that was that they were going to retcon the apocalyptic ending of season 2. Well, obviously, they had to. And I knew that a lot of people weren't that impressed with it. So it was almost the opposite of season 2. I kind of went in with low expectations. It's the reason why I didn't try very hard to find a DVD. It's like, I'm not going to pay like £30 from Amazon for something that I might not enjoy. But, you know, I set out to watch it for the purpose of watching the X-Files episode. So it would be pointless for me to stop now, you know. But I was pleasantly surprised, actually, by a lot of season 3. The retcon, like, how many people died in that virus outbreak? Like 70, 80? Bear in mind, I am watching this now. Like, I watched this during an actual viral outbreak. Yeah. And so my standards for apocalypse might be slightly higher than they were back then. And so it's been like, okay, well, that kind of takes away from it a little bit. Okay, I'll get over it and try and enjoy the rest of the season. I was a bit like, okay, why are we back at the FBI? Like, this seems not... Millennium. This seems very X-Files. If I'm going to watch a 10-13 show about the FBI, well, I know what I'm going to watch. And the Millennium Group is more exciting than the FBI because the FBI represents convention because they have a rule book, and I'm less interested in that. It's not why I got into Millennium in the first place. But actually, on the other hand, I really like the FBI characters. I love Emma Hollis. I even really enjoy Agent Baldwin. Like, I was kind of genuinely sad when he died. And so, yeah, I think that the first half of season 3 is a bit eh, but from, say, like Borrowed Time onwards, I think it's really great. I even kind of enjoyed the beginning of Omerta, even though, like, it got a bit weird towards the end. But, like, there were things, and like, I know how you feel about 13 years later, but I didn't hate it. I quite enjoyed it. I was like, oh, this is fun. What's his name is in Robert Wisden, I think, is in one of the early episodes in season 3, and I was like, yeah, great. So even if the episode isn't great, I'm still like, good, nice to see him. Yeah. And yeah, so I basically, in conclusion, pleasantly surprised by season 3. probably would rewatch it more than I'd rewatch season one. Okay. Yeah. Again, like I think Emma Hollis was a fantastic addition to the show, even if sometimes it's like, okay, well, she's Scully. She even dresses very much like Scully. She wears the same like shirt with the collar, like the one that Scully wears in Fight the Future. I'm like, this seems oddly familiar. But yeah, I thought it was, at first I was like, this seems like a weird direction for Millennium to go. But by the end of the season, I was like, yeah, okay, I enjoyed that.
So if you had to pick out episodes then for season three, then what would you class as your favourite of the season?
I'm going to say this is hard because, like, yeah, this is hard, but I'm going to say goodbye to all that and slash Via Dolorosa because they go together. But I think this show does season finales really well. I think the season finales are like three hits, which is a much better ratio than you get in the X-Files, in my opinion. Like, it seemed to be like they pulled a bunch of things together that I wasn't expecting to happen, and I think that it was emotional, which when Millennium does the emotional stuff, they do it really well. I like Peter Watts, how he got like a mini, like kind of just like a sudden jolt of like development at the end of the season. I mean, he wasn't super present in season three. He kind of just like, oh, we don't like Peter now, okay, and then came back in a really satisfying way. Again, Agent Baldwin kind of had his moment. I just thought it was great. I'm still kind of, I think I'm still processing it. To be fair, I did not watch this that long ago, but
yeah,
in a way I'm still processing it. Like, it's a really good ending to the show. Like, that, like in the car with Frank and Jordan, that's all you needed, really. That sums it up pretty much.
It does. And then we get the X-Files Millennium episode. I don't know if you've heard our coverage of it either.
I have, yes. Well, the thing is, I feel like I think that there is a defense to be made of that episode.
I'm happy to hear it. Absolutely happy to hear it.
Okay, because you guys were talking about, well, what is Millennium about? It's not about zombies. Why is this about zombies? What's happening? I'm like, okay, yeah. Okay, fair enough. What is a Millennium about? Not zombies. Got it, Craig. But what is Millennium like about? And imagine I'm saying that in italics. Like, what would it, if Mulder and Scully are entering Frank Black's world, like, what does that really mean in a less literal sense? Essentially, what did we as a viewer learn from Millennium that we then want Mulder and Scully to learn? And it's essentially this, that this is how I've tried to summarize whatever the message of Millennium could be. It's like in the face of suffering, good people will be forced to compromise. But even where there is evil, there is paranoia and doubt, there's also There's light and there's love and there's hope. And this is what the Yellow House represents. It's what Catherine and especially what Jordan represents. The tagline, I think, on a poster for the Millennium pilot that I saw like earlier today said, evil has many faces, hope has one. And it's like, yeah, okay, is that Frank Black as the face of hope? Is it Jordan as the face of hope? Light in the darkness is what I've taken from Millennium. Then it makes sense that Millennium, I'm gonna call the episode of the X-Files 7X4 because that's how I think of it in my head. Because if I keep saying Millennium, it's gonna get confusing.
Yeah, it makes sense. We had that problem.
It makes sense to me that 7X4 is the one where Mulder and Scully kiss. And I will say this now, I'm not a shipper, but it makes sense to me because if there is a Yellow House in the X-Files, then Mulder's Yellow House is Scully. And Scully's Yellow House is Mulder. And so Frank and Jordan, as they literally exist in the episode, maybe weren't done justice. But there is a heart to Millennium that it's like the thematic torch has been passed from Frank and Jordan to Mulder and Scully in the hospital corridor.
Okay. I like that. I think, oh, that's good.
Yeah. I think I'd also recommend, I don't know if you know Pamela Stafford on Twitter wrote a blog entry about 7X4, which I found really, really interesting. It puts that episode into like the wider perspective of season 7, and it was like my third eye opened. I was like, oh my God, it all makes sense now.
It is really good, her articles that she writes. So definitely worth a look when you do see that. That will have to go on my shipping forecast. And after this episode is recorded, I'm going to have to go onto my XCast video chat app and speak to them about that, because that'll be interesting to see what their thoughts are on that.
I don't know how I feel about inadvertently creating a shipping forecast.
Anyway, it's fine. That's what I'm doing for season 7 of the XCast. So.
Yeah, wow.
but never mind. But then you look at like things beyond, say, the ramifications, not only of Millennium, you mentioned about passing the torch there for Millennium to the X-Files, but then you look at something like I Want to Believe, the film. Do you see the Millennium aspects in that film? Do you like that film? I know we're moving into X-Files territory here, yeah. But do you see the comparisons or some of the aspects which Millennium has with Chris Carter's writing in that show?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think even starting at I Want to Believe, starting at the beginning of season 7 onwards, there was a sudden influx of Millennium mystic stuff in the X-Files, which I enjoyed because I liked Millennium. But I Want to Believe, not as good as Fight the Future, in my opinion, but I can appreciate where it stands in the kind of in Modern Studies continuity. Like, I do think that the thing about, you know, the darkness intruding on their world is very interesting and ought to be explored. I can see why someone would argue that it is very Millennium, isn't it, actually, now I'm thinking about it. But
yeah, it does.
Interesting. Chris Carter's got his things, hasn't he? He's got his things. We could be like, yeah, that's Chris Carter.
he does.
It's even like, I was even thinking about Harsh Realm, because I just listened to the X-Files special episode about it, and about how does that thematically relate to X-Files and Millennium. And it's you know, that episode where the dude, Pinocchio gets his leg blown off in Harsh Realm, and so it's kind of like a thing while he's been injured in real life, and when he entered Harsh Realm, he got like his healthy body restored. We'll not go into why that might be problematic, but you know, he had his healthy body restored and then like subsequently injured again. And so it's like the you can go into like the kind of magical, it's not really magical, is it, Harsh Realm, but you know, the kind of he goes into this alternate realm where things are suddenly made better for him, but then, oh no, it comes along and everything's dark again. Like, it's a very 10-13 Chris Carter thing to have like the light and then have the darkness intruding on it. Luckily, you also have it the other way around, which is, I think, why we love the shows. But it's all about light and dark. It's all about how you can't escape the darkness. It's kind of depressing when you think about it for too long.
you do have to swap out sometimes Millennium with other things. So the only thing we haven't really touched upon then is what do you think to, because X-Files, we've discussed this a lot on The Time Is Now with likes of Legion, for example. You've got 7 and 1 in season 3, which I think is a really it's an episode that's definitely growing on me the more I think about it, and could potentially quite easily be transported over to the X-Files in season 7 and season 8, especially with my re-evaluation as we go through it on the X-Cast. But so you've got the Legion, you've got Lucy Butler, you've got things like that happening. Yeah, as you say, the Owls and Roosters, the schisms in the group, and you've got the kind of the arc of the Millennium Group becoming, you know, the main baddies of the piece. So overall then for Millennium, what do you make to the kind of the more mythological mythos kind of aspect to the show?
Well, I think that I like the Millennium Group as like all of their storylines in the same way that I like the Syndicate storylines in the X-Files. I love the kind of the evil institution. I love the intrigue. Peter Watts is a great character and he's a great way into that. I don't like Lucy Butler. Like, I don't like those storylines because I don't like her as a concept. It's just kind of, I mean, like I've written about this, but the kind of the incubus / succubus gender shifting evil thing is like, well, just like slightly uncomfortable. You know, like having a character who can like change sex being like the physical embodiment of evil feels slightly dodgy to my 21st century perspective. And so like I'm not massive on that. I also feel like that's harder, like as a mythology thing, that's harder for me to grasp onto because it's more like fantasy.
We've got a couple of questions that we haven't asked and then we'll wrap this up. And thank you very much for coming and talking about it, especially with your, as I say, your 21st century viewpoints, because it's nice to know that Millennium still has legs in the world.
It absolutely does, yeah.
Who would you consider to be your favourite character? Could be Frank. It's definitely not Lucy Butler from the sounds of it. So would it be Frank for you? And if it is Frank, I will give you another pass and say he would be a secondary character after that.
Okay, yes, I'm going to do that. I'm going to say Frank is my favourite, but can I have a secondary character? Man, this is really difficult. This is so hard. But do you know what's interesting? Like, I watched Aliens the other day, and, like, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Aliens, it's, like, really old, so that's your problem. But the bit where the alien, like, rips Lance Henriksen in half, yeah. Like, I just went, oh, no, Frank. Oh, man, that hurt a little. Frank's great, but it's so hard. It's so hard to pick a favourite character. Like, when I was thinking about the questions, I was like, I don't know how to pick. So, can I be really annoying and say I have a different favourite character for each season?
Go for it. You know, it's a groundbreaking episode, this one, so go for it.
Yes. Okay. Season one, my favourite character is Catherine, because she immediately struck me as, in all this darkness, she stands out as being so compassionate and so empathetic. And I was she's just lovely. Like, I don't know. She's just really nice. That's basically my justification. She's a nice person. And then season two, I'm going to say Peter Watts. Season two, Peter is my favorite Peter, because you have, like, you have on the one hand, you have Peter as Frank's friend, and like the friend character, the mentor / sidekick character is fun. And it's Terry O'Quinn, you know? On the other hand, you have the darker Peter, the intriguing Peter who keeps secrets. And that's like really exciting for me. I'm like, oh, a character who's keeping secrets. I'm on board with that. It's just good storytelling. And every time he's on screen, I'm like, yeah, this is going to be good. I feel like it's 90% Terry O'Quinn. Although actually I could say that about any of the characters. I think all of the casting was like superb. But season three, my favorite character is Emma Hollis. Again, I think she was like a great addition, even though I was a bit like, why are we in the FBI? I was happy to settle for the FBI because Emma Hollis is great. She becomes more interesting over the season, because at first I was like, okay, so it's Scully, basically. By the end, she's like a whole character, which is good. I would say that maybe Millennium is marginally better at writing female characters than the X-Files is, but that is a whole other can of worms. I mean, like Emma even has like her own foil in Barry Baldwin, who I also quite like. And so it just shows, I don't know, it's like a good one season arc. I wish she had come back in the X-Files crossover, like, but whatever, I'm sure there are reasons for that. But again, it was like whenever she was on screen, I was like, yeah. So, you know, that's a very, very intellectual answer.
Excellent. Right. So that's question four. So question five may well be the same answer as your favorite episode, but what is your favourite moment from the series? It could be 90 seconds, it could be 9 minutes, it could be 2 seconds. So what would you consider to be your favourite moment?
It is not the same. It is not from my favourite episode. It is from the pilot, and I'm sure someone else has probably said this one, but it is the moment when they open the box and they find the young man who's had his face sewn shut, and Frank like takes him into his arms, and this boy, he's like a teenager. He is sobbing, but it's muffled because his mouth is sewn shut, and Frank just holds him. And my goodness, that was like, I was like, yes, this was worth spending my money on the DVDs for. Like, I'm so excited to watch the rest of the show. It was like nothing I'd seen in the X-Files. It was, it was just one moment that was so, it was terrifying. Wait, wasn't, I swear, later that episode, what's his face? The guy says in 18 years I've never seen anything like I saw tonight, and me being 18 watching that and being like, yeah man, same. it's so like, I think the word visceral gets overused, but it's emotional, it's dark, it sets up Frank as a character, and I swear I can hear the boy crying, like when I close my eyes, like that's never left me. Again, it's been 5 months, so I'm being a little bit over dramatic here, but that is my favorite moment, because it was like, yeah, okay, we're rolling now.
Oh, great stuff. Well, I'm actually didn't intend this, and you'll have seen it on Twitter last night, but I watched Gehenna last night, and I watched the pilot a couple of weeks ago. And rewatching the pilot again, that moment, that's fresh in my mind. The moment you're talking about in the pest box, it is just tells you everything you need to know about Frank.
Yeah.
But like sort of Gehenna, for example, when he does come face to face with the Frenchman in the lab, the goodbye to all that came to mind. And I think, like I've said in the podcast over the past 2 or 3 years that I've been doing this podcast, that my last rewatch before doing this this podcast was really interesting itself, because I hadn't watched it for so long that if I was to watch the Owls and Roosters, it would be in seldom to the show. It would be more a case of, I want fancy watching that episode today. Or it would be the time is now, fancy watching that today, or the Curse of Frank Black, which is obviously a Halloween episode. You'd watch that every Halloween. So watching the episodes that I was involved in for the podcast was really quite intriguing, and being in the world of the podcast and listening to people's discussion on it, and not necessarily hearing all of them. That obviously I've been on the majority of the episodes, but not all of them. So sometimes I'd be watching an episode and I'd listen back to it. But this time on rewatching Gehenna, it just became more apparent to me that there was things that was jumping out because of the podcast. And I think that's going to be interesting. As I say, with it being its 25th year as well, that I've got a feeling that by the time we get to the 26th of October, whichever date it was that it originally aired in 1996, that I'll either be majority of the way through the first season, or at least maybe even hitting the second season. And it's just going to be really interesting to see these new, seeing the episodes in a new light again, the fact that I've watched it maybe 3 times in the last 5 or 6 years. So I hope that you do that. You get some time away from it, and you might manage to get to see the episodes again and see some things that you might have not seen on the podcast. Have you listened to all of the podcasts as well so far? Are you behind, or where are you with that?
I've listened to all the way through. Like, I may have skipped a couple. I can't remember for sure if I listened to all of the season one episodes. Yeah,
right.
I mean, I've enjoyed it as much as I enjoy the X-Cast. It's brilliant. I mean, like, but I am like genuinely grateful to have these podcasts, because like, you guys really know your stuff, and I feel like if it weren't for the X-Cast for a start, I would never have watched Millennium. And so it's, and you know, I'm grateful for you guys helping me with my English A level. That was great.
we'll take that, we'll put that in our tagline for the podcast moving forward.
Yeah, it's great. but yeah, I have, and I'm excited to hear more for the 25th anniversary, and I imagine I will probably watch the pilot on October 25th, and maybe that will begin my next rewatch. Although, having said that, I'll probably be done with my current X-Files rewatch, not the one along with the X-Cast, but yeah. It will be interesting to watch it all again, because I have gone back and watched a few. Like, I've watched the pilot, I've watched Gehenna again, and I watched a few for like essay research. But I've watched the Mikado and In Arcadia Ego again. But other than that, I've not touched season two, because I'm like, it was great the first time around, and I don't want season three or anything to like become my is a bit. But as I'm like looking at the list of episodes, I'm like, this is exciting. I can't wait to be able to go back and watch this.
Excellent.
I've seen people talk about in like on the Facebook group, oh, Millennium was one of the shows that shaped my youth, or Millennium was one of the shows that I've kept with me over all these years. And I'm like, well, I can't really say that yet, because I'm still in my youth. But I wonder if like in another 25 years, I'll be talking about how Millennium affected me for years to come. And it's kind of exciting. It's exciting that television like this exists. And it's exciting that it has crossed into my life.
So I'm just going to quickly go to the Yellow House, the Millennium Podcast fan group. I asked the question a few days ago saying, how did you discover Millennium, knowing that we were going to record this? And it is interesting, because you've got people who are saying, like Noah Stilton says, was on every Friday when I was 13. It was always my favourite show and still is. And I remember I was 16 going on 17 when Millennium's first episode came out. It was 96 and I was 17 in 97. And I think Millennium might have been slightly behind schedule for the UK. So that was interesting watching it as a 16, 17-year-old, you know, seeing those first episodes. And the pilot for me was especially gripping, because I've not seen anything like that when I was 16 or 17 years old. But you get people like, I'll go through a couple of them on here. So Whitley Powell says, I saw a great many ads during the summer. Lance was always one of my favourite actors, and the rest is history. So you mentioned like the alien stuff. So Lance Henriksen was obviously well known at that point. You know, he's done the alien stuff. He's a notable figure in the world of movies and TV. Well, not necessarily TV, but you know, even that, thinking about that nowadays, you've got like sort of 24, which had Kiefer Sutherland, that, you know, those were the big kind of shows that kind of started to use movie actors properly, and that became a thing in the early 2000s as well. You've got David Babcock saw the original commercials. So not only was it just X-Files, but people, you know, just seeing commercials on air. I mean, it was 17.2 million that saw the first episode, which is amazing to think about, especially given it now. Greg McVeigh, I was channel surfing, caught the tail end of Amnesis, and I became interested in it. I have all three seasons in DVD. Stuart Wood, in the UK, it was trailed as from the creator of The X-Files, and given its darker themes, I thought it would be worth a look. Opening with a lap dancer, blood running down the walls, visions of hell, and Nine Inch Nails on the soundtrack, and that was all before the opening credits. I was hooked. That's a very good question, actually. So the opening scene, you said that you were aware of Millennium and you were aware of the pilot. What did you make to that very first opening credit scene?
The one in the Peep Show.
In the pilot. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at first I was a bit, well, honestly, like my first reaction was, this is a little male gazy. Chris Carter, what are you up to? So at first I was like, oh my goodness, I hope they don't like, I hope this isn't, they're not objectifying these women or whatever. That was honestly like one of my first thoughts, because 21st century. And obviously the way the episode goes, it's not really like that. It's not my kind of show. The blood freaked me out. Like, I'm not great with blood as a starter. I mean, it's fine if it's like injury detail, but it's a lot. Like, it's a lot. I was like, oh man, when they said this was going to be dark, like, they meant it. And yeah, I mean, did someone say they watched this when they were 13? That's nuts. Like, yeah. That's kind of nuts. like, I'd even say that's quite young to watch The X-Files, but, I mean, that's me, I guess, but yeah.
Yeah, well, X-Files, I was around 13, 14 when I started watching it. So, but as I say, Millennium, it kind of, it was, I probably was in the right zone because it was an pretty much an 18 show, really, with me watching it when I was 16 or 17. It kind of like was like, oh, this is not quite really meant for me, but I'm really enjoying it. So I think I was in, just in the right moment for the show personally.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I am 18. And it was still like really affecting. Obviously it depends on individual people, but I think that it earns its age rating. I think that, and the pilot is ample enough proof of that.
Okay, so Elisa Johnson says, I have always been a fan of Lance Henriksen and grew up on The X-Files. So I decided to look up his work one night some years ago to find about the series. And then I watched it completely. I could never watch The X-Files again because Millennium was the far better series to me.
Damn.
Yeah. So,
wow.
And she's not alone in that, you know, because Tony Black has said that sometimes The X-Files, you know, is his favourite TV show, but, you know, at moments, Millennium is better. I think Millennium has, you know, I wouldn't do a podcast on Millennium if I didn't think it was a fantastic TV show.
Yeah.
And I do think that there, if I was to do a top 10 of X-Files and Millennium, that there would be some serious competition from Millennium to get into that show. So,
yeah.
You know, I do think there is absolutely aspects that I think Millennium is a different show to me, so I can't really compare the two. But I do feel that at times Millennium has the better episodes. I was thinking of Gehenna. Gehenna's a great episode, and it's, you know, there is better X-Files episodes, but there's not many. And I would say the same for the pilot. So
I think that, like, technically there are better Millennium episodes than there are X-Files episodes. I mean, only maybe, like, a few. But I can't imagine ever saying, oh, I'm never going to watch The X-Files again because this show is better. Because the thing about The X-Files is, like, you can really, like, fall into it, you know? Like, there's so much, like, and people get so attached to Mulder and Scully. And I love Frank Black, and as I said, it hurt me a little bit watching Aliens. But it doesn't seem the kind of show, you know, like, people aren't really writing Millennium fan fiction. They're not buying Millennium merchandise in the same way that they are with the X-Files. They don't want... why am I generalizing? I mean, I say from my perspective, like, I don't think Millennium is going to become part of my life in the same way the X-Files is. And that's not to say that I don't love Millennium and will continue watching Millennium and writing about Millennium. But it's not like a thing that I'm going to use. I'm not going to watch it before I go to bed, you know? Like, that's I mean, like, fair play to them, but, like, if I had to let go of one of them, then it would be Millennium, as much as I will concede that there are some episodes of Millennium that are technically better than the best episodes of the X-Files.
Yeah, absolutely. There's room for they're both live in the same universe, there's room for them both.
Yeah.
Tabby Aducius, I was at home watching Chiller TV when they were playing reruns. So that's interesting. I don't think I've seen, and maybe something like the Horror Channel would potentially see Millennium. I am aware, will be some years back now, that Millennium was on some TV late at night here in the UK. But that is the only way in which people would now really get to see it. If you are having struggles 5 or 6 months ago for getting season 3, then that is concerning. You know, Disney Plus have got Fox now. You know, I know the Millennium, after the Millennium people are also doing 25th anniversary specials, and it'd be interesting to see what they come up with and what they do. But it's certainly a big issue for Millennium fans, for new viewers, really. You know, you have to come through it.
It is.
Have to get through the gateway of X-Files, and I feel that's really disappointing.
Yes, and the thing is, like, I was just speaking to someone, like on my Instagram account. I was, like, talking about Millennium on my X-Files Instagram, don't remember. But and she just said, oh, would you recommend Millennium? And I was like, yes, please watch Millennium, you'll love it. And she was like, oh, where is it? Where did you watch it? And I was like, I brought the DVDs. And she's like, oh, never mind then. Like, it's not easy, and it's so sad because, like, the 25th anniversary is coming up, and And you've got to, like, imagine, like, the 30th anniversary of The X-Files is coming up in a couple of years, and I can already foresee the kind of, like, things that are going to happen on television. Like, you can even imagine, like cinemas will show the pilot. Like, I know that there's a cinema in London that sometimes shows TV shows for special events. And yeah. But if, like, I don't think it's just going to pass the world by, the 25th anniversary of Millennium, because no one knows about it unless they, you know, the people who watched it in the 90s maybe didn't have to go through the X-Files, but now people don't so much. And I don't know what to tell people who want to watch it, because they might not necessarily want to commit in the same way that I did to buying DVDs. But yeah, it's a real shame.
Exactly. It's only a few gigabytes. Disney, just put it on there. It'll be fine.
Exactly.
If Lie to Me with Tim Roth can be on, which only lasted a season and a half, Millennium can be on there. So we'll see. Watch this space. You know, we might have a surprise. There might be, Disney Plus might start showing it, at which point we'll have to kind of push people to watch, to listen to a certain podcast, but we'll see.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, so Chiller TV. So I think X-Files has been rerun in America as well on certain channels, or Canadian TV. Yeah. So something like Chiller TV, horror TV channels over here have got things like The 4400, which I watched last night. I've got the DVDs of them as well. So there's always potential for these shows to make an appearance somewhere. Ed McKay says, started with The X-Files, then captivated by Millennium. The Lone Gunman and even Harsh Realm, which wasn't given a real chance. That's fine. Mark McGrath was already a fan of Lance Henriksen and The X-Files, so when Chris Carter decided to put Lance in his new show, I was on board from day one. Andrew Charles Cook was an X-Files fan when I was a kid, so I tried Millennium. Had to be around seven. Too scary. Well, yeah, a seven-year-old, goodness. I think, is maybe a bit too. Bought the box sets right out of high school. Anna Champ, I watched it from the very beginning and actually changed my life. That may sound overly dramatic, but it's true on a number of levels. Michael John Petty, he's been on the podcast a few times. My dad discovered it when it came out on DVD. He and my mum watched The X-Files live, and he introduced me to it way too young in the early 2000s. Millennium intrigued him, so he bought the DVD sets and we started watching. It was a lot to ask of me as a kid, but when I was in high school and definitely by college, I picked it up again and fell in love with the series for myself. Such a good show, and to this day, one of my all-time favourites. And then finally, Jeffrey Scott. I was there from the beginning. My wife and I were avid X-Files fans, and I was attracted to the show by the tone of the current times we were living through. I think it should be revived because the current state of society, the show would right itself. Now, you mentioned that. So what was it like? Bearing in mind we've had a pandemic over the last 18 months to 2 years, watching a show where there is a Marburg virus flying around at the end of season two. What was that like for you?
I mean, it was, there's this thing where now when you watch films, I watched Soylent Green because of Millennium, and people like wearing face masks. Any time now where you see people wearing PPE in media, it hits slightly different, you know. And it was kind of like the thing with the vaccine about not having enough to go around, that I feel like that just kind of made me angry at like people now who are refusing to get a vaccine, because I'm like, Catherine Black didn't have a choice, okay? You have a choice. Like, it really does hit hard, because I think even more so, I can imagine what Frank must have felt like trying to protect his family. I mean, like, you know, I don't have children, but I've been at home with my parents and my sibling for this, and I've, as have like so many people, that I understand more than I probably would have appreciated just how terrifying, like just thinking back to like the first lockdown where everything was super unsure and we didn't know what was going on and everything happened so suddenly, like a teacher just walked into my classroom and said, right, you guys are going home now, and that was that.
Right.
Like the I could relate to it on that level. I feel like it would have been scary and intense anyway, but it felt more like it felt more like it was a sign to me that I was watching the show at the right time. That if people watch Millennium Now and who have now lived through the coronavirus outbreak, it should be a sign that, like, if you can, like, hug your Jordan, like, sit with your Jordan and be like, because, you know, whoever that may be, yeah. If you don't have children, then it's your friends, it's whoever. It puts things in perspective, and it made it possibly, I can't say what I would have felt like having watched it at a different time, but it did, the impact that The Time Is Now, that episode had on me, was really a lot. Like, there were multiple reasons why I took a break between seasons 2 and 3, and I needed a moment, like, to yeah. to process that. It's an experience watching any kind of apocalyptic dramas now, any kind of medical dramas, like even the X-Files, when they have things, when Scully's wearing PPE in an autopsy lab, it's just a bit like, oh, okay, that doesn't feel so abnormal anymore.
Okay, well, Christopher, thank you very much for coming on and talking about Millennium and what you've gone through over the last few seasons of watching it so recently as well, which is fantastic to hear. As I say, with it being the 25th anniversary, I thought it was just something that we could do, maybe a different take on it, and you provided some great answers there. You've mentioned a couple of times you've written about Millennium, and I did read your article on the 25 years site. Do you want to give us just a brief overview of what that was, and are you considering doing any more pieces on Millennium, and where can people find them?
So it's on 25 Years Later, which is a site that Tony Black writes for also. And so basically after watching In Arcadia Ego and The Thin White Line, I was struck by how unusual it felt to me to be watching a 90s show that had episodes about same-sex couples, particularly In Arcadia Ego, and how it was handled then. So I set out writing an article about that. I quickly found that there's a lot more in Millennium than just those two episodes. So I wrote an article about queerness in Millennium, specifically how it relates to the gothic genre. Perhaps this is something that is less appreciated by, like, the cishet masses who engage with gothic media, that this was the home of queer stories, and to an extent remains the home of queer stories. And it felt quite intimidating to research, because I am so new to Millennium, and I was like, there's going to be someone out there who knows these episodes better than I do. But it was fun. It was interesting. There's a lot of literary archaeology that you can do with this show. And so if you're interested in the queer perspective of Millennium, then I wrote an article about it. Yeah,
you did, and I think it's interesting to see, as I say, just a modern take on the show. And you mentioned about Pamela Stafford, and just the different viewpoints that different people have are really intriguing. And I think that, you know, taking the time out to talk about things, I think The Thin White Line was one that you mentioned, and I'd say In Arcadia Ego, and and even elements on the pilot and things was really, really insightful. And it was a really real pleasure to read it, and I thought it was interesting. And as you say, with the Lucy Butler stuff, as a Lucy Butler fan, it was nice to hear that kind of comment, because it's something that I would not have put together at all. And it's really, really good to have insights like that. And I definitely encourage people to read that article. So are you planning on any future writings on the show, or is it just going to come naturally to you? How do you decide what you're going to write about?
I have ideas in the works, not specifically for Millennium, but for more 10/13 stuff. I'd love to write more on Millennium. It's a case of what, but the site really encourages, like, articles about specific characters, which seems like it might be exciting for me. I will I would love to write an article about Peter Watts, for example. So in future, this will not be my last Millennium article, but I cannot say when or how it will the next one will arrive. But yeah,
that's absolutely fine. But yeah, keep an eye. You've written things on Interstellar and all kinds as well, haven't you? So
yeah,
there's plenty to read on that 25 years later site, which is well worth it. I keep an eye on the articles that pop up on that website because they are really good. So if people wanted to get in touch with you, if you wanted to sort of discuss what you've heard on the podcast or want to follow you, where's the best? You mentioned the Instagram. I mentioned, you haven't, I'm surprised, about Alex Krycek. He hasn't come up that often. But Instagram and Twitter and the likes, where can people find you online?
So I'm on Twitter at chpilbeam, and I where I'm happy to talk to anyone about Millennium. I'd love that. And I am on Instagram at Year of the Rat Boy. I'm doing a scene-by-scene analysis of Alex Krycek. By the time this episode comes out, I will be very close to finishing. So it'll be interesting to see how far along I am by then. But yeah, please come join me.
You can find me on Twitter at R Muldrake. That's R-M-U-L-D-R-A-K-E. You can also find me at the same handle on Instagram as well, when I actually get round to posting stuff on there, which is very rare at the moment. But there's other things that I've got on Red Dwarf podcast, which is the Shipwrecked and Comatose. You can find that at Red Dwarf Pod. The X-Cast, obviously, we're currently covering season 7, so I'll be making preparations for season 8 by the time this airs, I would have thought. So yeah, come and find us over there, then the X_cast. But Millennium and X-Files and Red Dwarf aren't the only things we're discussing on the podcast network even. And you'll get a flavour of what has been happening over on the We Made This Podcast Network in a few seconds. But until next time, remember everyone, this is who we are.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Make It So, a Star Trek Picard podcast.
Why do you even need to bring that up? Mm. You don't. We've done a story, and you're just using that for the. God, no! It's like, no. I don't get it. I understand yeah. I understand Soongs. Soongs are always going to be in some way related to the Khan story because of genetics and the stuff like that they've done. I get it, but to do that, and if it comes in season 3, if it's a main thing in season 3. Then I'll hold judgment. If it doesn't get mentioned in season 3, then what was the point?
Pick a disc.
Guardian reading lefty, which
a bleeding heart is one of the phrases we use a lot here in the US. Like, he cares about the homeless. I'm sort of shifting into my Limbaugh impersonation. Oh, he wants to house the homeless. What is he, a communist? Like, you know, that's not. Maybe a little, but he's concerned with this. He's concerned with climate change. He's concerned with poverty. He's concerned with just general treatment of your fellow human beings. Like, I'm sure he resents having been subjected to trauma in his own life, and that gives him a great deal of sympathy, which I think is a good quality.
Geek polymer.
Third one, are the following names of hops, US space shuttles, or both?
Brilliant.
First one, Atlantis.
No, it's a US space shuttle, but is it a hop? I'm going to say it's just a US space shuttle.
Correct.
Good.
I've
got to get best of three again.
I didn't know that was a space shuttle. Well, that's my poor knowledge, that is. second one, Galaxy.
I know that that's a hop, because I've seen it in a pub recently. I don't know if it's a space shuttle, so I'm going to say both.
Just a hop, that one.
Oh, damn it.
Next one, Endeavour.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This Podcast Network.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This Podcast Network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, and X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.